The U.S. is going after Venezuelan oil tankers, but Venezuela is not the only country feeling the pain.
If Venezuela falls, Cuba then will be next.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also on the show, the contributions of women in Russia from the dawn of the Soviet era to today.
The women are just constantly heaving this country called Russia on their backs and dragging it forward in spite of itself, keeping the place together in spite of itself.
The women in One Russian Family bring that history to life.
Plus, athletes marking major firsts from a climber in Colombia.
I was like, yes, 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 please.
To a Kenyan darts protege.
No way! No way! What is going on here?
Today, here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us today.
The U.S. is pursuing a third tanker bringing oil to and from Venezuela as tensions escalate between Washington and Caracas. The U.S. and Venezuela are the main actors in this standoff, but the blockade is wreaking havoc on another country, Cuba.
Cuba is dependent on Venezuelan oil, and people in Cuba are now going without even the electrical power for so much as a ceiling fan to stay cool in the sweltering heat, not to mention going hungry. We begin today with Jorge Piñon, who studies Cuba's energy infrastructure at the University of Texas at Austin. Piñon, describe for us the conditions right now in Cuba.
They're chaotic and very dangerous because the country, based on the Electric Power Authority this morning, 60% of the system was down this morning, of the thermoelectric power system. It creates a lot of havoc, not only in personal life of people, but also businesses and the whole economy. So they're certainly going through a crisis right now.
60% of the system is down in Cuba, and you see that as a direct consequence of the oil not coming as rapidly as it should from Venezuela?
Part of it is that, particularly diesel fuel that they need for their distributed power. But also they're forced to burn Cuban crude oil, domestic production, which is a very high sulfur, heavy, high metals crude, which is not good in these thermoelectric power plants that are over 50 years old. So is the quality and the amount of oil that they're not getting from Venezuela one of the root causes of the problems with the electric power sector.
So describe for us the extent of Cuba's dependence on Venezuelan oil.
Cuba today has a demand of about 100,000 barrels a day. That's about down 20% from the last couple of years. Of that 100, they produce 40,000 barrels a day of domestic heavy crude oil production. So their deficit is 60. Venezuela is currently supplying them with about 50% of that, about 30,000 barrels a day. By the way, Marco, from a high of about 100,000 barrels a day, about 10 years ago. So we have seen Venezuelan supply in the last 10 years drop by 70%. The balance of the deficit is covered by Mexico, who again has dropped their exports to Cuba by about 75% this year. And then Russia, we still see a couple of cargoes a year come in. We're very surprised about Russian supply. We thought that it was going to be more volume coming from them, but it hasn't materialized.
So I'm really curious to know how Cuba's energy system became so dependent on the subsidies from Venezuela. How'd that happen?
Because it was a political relationship going back to Fidel Castro and Chavez.
Hugo Chavez, the former president.
Correct. Hugo Chavez. They signed in 2000 an agreement. Cuba would supply Venezuela with doctors, all kind of technology, and then Venezuela will pay that in oil. This was basically free oil, 100,000 barrels a day, free oil from Venezuela, no negative cash flow. And by the way, the same thing with Mexico. They have their last year supplied Cuba with 20,000 barrels a day, again, on a no cash flow transaction for services provided by Cuba.
As far as the more recent weeks, we know the U.S. has already halted a tanker carrying 2 million barrels of Venezuelan oil bound for Cuba. How much damage did that one seizure do to the Cuban economy?
Well, that oil, by the time that it gets into the pipeline and into the distribution systems, it would have taken at least 25 to 30 days. So I think Cuba's horizon is very dark, very cloudy, very stormy. because of the lack of oil and the uncertainty of what's going to happen. Yesterday, for example, a Russian tanker, which is sanctioned, arrived in the Cuban port of Matanzas, unloading about 350,000 barrels. That tanker was able to get through. So there's a lot of confusion about, is the oil that is sanctioned or are the tankers being sanctioned by the U.S. government? Is it just the Venezuelan tankers and Venezuelan oil and not the Russian tankers or the Russian oil? So there is a lot of uncertainty, and that is making the Cubans, of course, very, very nervous.
So if this U.S. blockade continues, can the Cuban economy survive?
No. The engine of the Cuban economy, of course, was tourism, which we have seen drop by about 50% post-pandemic and is still dropping. Sugar exports are zero. Cuba is now importing sugar from the U.S. and Guyana and Brazil and other countries.
Well, let me take your dark and stormy prognosis, Jorge, for Cuba a bit further. There's a tendency to see the news as the U.S. squeezing the Maduro regime because of its authoritarianism, and Cuba is suffering the consequences. But we should recognize that a Cuba hawk is at the head of the State Department, Marco Rubio. Do you think the Trump White House is looking at Venezuela and Cuba and hoping for regime change in two places?
No question about it. I think that we're looking at a domino type of strategy. That if Venezuela falls, Cuba then will be next. Now, be careful. That's a double-edged sword. Who is now going to supply Cuba with oil? Who is now going to prevent Cuba to become a failed state? Who is now going to help Cuba become the independent and democratic and prosperous nation that we all want? Are we going to have another Haiti in our hands? So the fact that Venezuela could cut off supplies to Cuba in the future, that is, again, a double-edged sword. We think, by the way, that that's why there was a drop in Mexican crude oil deliveries. I think the U.S. and Mexico must have reached some sort of an agreement.
Well, zoom out for a moment, Jorge. You're a Cuban exile and a former Shell and Amoco executive. From your experience in international oil markets, how sustainable is a model where fuel is exchanged for medical and other services?
No, that's not sustainable at all. That's not the way the industry works. This is a very bumpy road that we're traveling on, and it's going to be very, very challenging. A lot of question marks that we still don't have answers for.
Jorge Piñon is a fellow at the Energy Institute at the University of Texas, Austin. Christmas, of course, is just around the corner.
On the first day of Christmas, my true love sent to me a partridge in a pear tree.
In France, it's not about the 12 days of Christmas, but rather the 8 scams of Christmas. The consumer watchdog group Foodwatch has an annual list where they highlight holiday treats to avoid. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
Imagine you're a parent in France in the lead-up to Christmas. Your small child is bouncing off the walls with excitement, so you pass out a French Christmas classic to calm the kid down, if just for a bit. A fizzy brand Santa Claus Giga Twisty lollipop. What could go wrong? This product from Fizzy is full-on Christmas, says Foodwatch's Camille Doriot. It has Christmassy colors, he says. There's Santa's face on it. And yet, this sweet little Santa comes bearing hidden gifts that no child would add to his or her Christmas list.
C'est-à-dire que là, on est face à un produit qui va contenir plus de 7 additifs à l'intérieur.
The Giga Twisty contains more than 7 additives, Dorio says, some of which are dyes, including one called E133, which is suspected of promoting allergies and hyperactivity in children. Beware, frazzled parent, that Christmas fizzy might just send your kid into fifth gear. Fizzy is just one of several companies Foodwatch is calling attention to. It's run this campaign at Christmas for several years now, because at this time of year, Dorio says, people tend to splurge, to indulge without thinking, and companies take advantage of that. For as long as companies treat consumers like pigeons, he says, who will just peck anything off the supermarket shelves during the holidays, we at Foodwatch will hold them accountable. Among the other dubious holiday offerings on those supermarket shelves this year, There's a pricey ready-made dish called a three-fish terrine. It contains very little fish. What it does have, an emulsifier called carrageenan, which some studies suggest is linked to type 2 diabetes. Then there's the holiday favorite foie gras, a pâté made from goose or duck livers. French food producer La Berry offers one with a splash of Armagnac, a local spirit. It's marketed as a gourmet holiday appetizer.
Je suis Emmanuel Chardin, responsable foie gras La Berry, garant de notre charte d'excellence.
In a promotional video, you see cute ducks on a pond, then a sterile laboratory-like workshop where workers season the livers. The voiceover says La Berry's foie gras is of the highest quality.
Mais malheureusement, on retrouve dans ce produit des nitrites et des nitrates ajoutés.
But unfortunately, this foie gras contains sodium nitrate, says Doriot, which is associated with colorectal cancer. Food Watch says La Berry has responded to its campaign and pledged to drop sodium nitrate as an additive. Doriot says they'll monitor the company to ensure they follow through. We've had about 50 victories like this over the years, he says, including cases where the packaging is deceptively large. Take a bag of Christmas chocolates from the supermarket chain Lidl. The bottom third of the bag is transparent and it looks packed full, but flip it over and the chocolates disappear from the little window. Turns out the top two-thirds of the bag is empty. It's misleading and wasteful, Doriot says. I point out that consumers could always flip the bag too, you know, conduct some minimum due diligence right there in the aisle.
On n'a pas le temps, je veux dire, moi j'ai autre chose à faire que moi c'est mon métier de retourner les boîtes dans les supermarchés, mais je
It's my job to turn packages upside down in supermarkets, Doriot says. But consumers in a hurry before Christmas, I think they'd rather be spending time with their family than flipping packaging in supermarkets. Time with family without having to worry about what's in the grocery cart. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon, Barcelona.
Darts may not dominate sports banter in the U.S., but for diehard fans, it is go time.
Welcome back to the Paddy Power World Darts Championship.
The World Darts Championship is happening right now in London.
128 of the best players are competing. There's $1.3 million in prize money at stake, the biggest payday in the history of darts.
Luke Littler, a Brit, is perhaps the most famous player there. He made history a few years ago when he became the youngest person to ever make it to the finals. He was just 16 at the time.
It's crazy. Crazy to even think I'm in my World Championship final on my debut. I was happy winning one game, but I could nearly go all the way.
Last year, he did go all the way. He won the crown and hopes to sweep the field again this year.
There's also excitement around a new player on the scene, David Munya. The 30-year-old is a veterinarian by day and a darts champ by night. His first round took the room by complete surprise.
No way! No way! Can't even make it up! What is going on here? He's on a 9-9 leg!
Munya is the first competitor ever from Kenya to play in the tournament, and he won that first match.
Munya came from behind to beat Belgian Mike de Decker, number 18 in the world. That earned him a congratulations from none other than Kenya's president, William Ruto. On Twitter, Ruto wrote to Munya, "As you advance to the next stage, know that the nation stands behind you. Bring the trophy home."
The trophy won't be going to Kenya, though. Munya lost today in the second round, but fans on social media are already singing his praises, calling him the people's champion.
Munya has competed in darts tournaments all over Africa, but this is reportedly his first time leaving the continent.
Water is in short supply in Iran, so is clean air. A check-in with Tehran is next. You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Buehler. An environmental problem that's long plagued Iran is getting worse. I'm talking about air pollution. Measurements taken today show Tehran had the seventh worst air quality in the world. Pollution has been bad all year, exacerbated by catastrophic drought. Kaveh Madani is a former deputy environment minister in the Iranian government. He now directs the Institute for Water, Environment, and Health at the United Nations University in Canada. He says this episode is bringing some of the worst air quality the country has seen in decades.
It's no longer only happening in the capital, Tehran. Now it's happening In almost every major city, but Tehran this year had only 6 clean days, and that should speak for itself. And it's very
6 days all year.
All year, yes, that's like 6 clean days, and
where the air quality met, you know, accepted standards.
Standards, exactly, and is affecting people, affecting the health of people, children, the elderly, and people with underlying health conditions.
Tell me more about the health problems that people are experiencing. Is it clear, you know, whether cases of respiratory illness have increased at hospitals, etc.?
Always, it's very hard to get the statistics, but yes, the news tell us that the hospitals are seeing more cases, or even people are telling us that they have had family members with trouble. Last night, actually, a friend was telling me about her mother that has had to leave Tehran for the last few months to live in one of the northern cities, and she had to buy an oxygen device to get that. So imagine what happens to the people who can't afford and they have to be outside and to have day-to-day activities.
Why is the air pollution so bad right now?
So this is not a problem created overnight. For a long, long time, you know, Iran has not been able to replace or renew its essentially public transportation. And then also cars are outdated. The fact that Iran is under sanctions, importing cars is problematic when it comes to technology.
Emissions are worse than from other cars.
In general, yes. But on top of that, you have the issue of gasoline being produced at home because gasoline imports went under sanctions many years ago. Add to that the fact that, again, under sanctions, they have not been able to build new power plants and overhaul the existing power plants. So many of them are not efficient in terms of production, or they cannot meet their name capacity. So that means that they had to rely on less cleaner forms of energy, electricity production. And now drought on top of these things, that means reduced hydropower production. So hydroelectricity production capacity has also dropped, which adds to this really, I would say, crazy mix.
And drought is also impacting air quality more directly, right? With dust?
So dust, we don't have that right now in Tehran, but that's another sort of pollution that can appear in some episodes. I would say, fortunately, that has not been experienced in recent months. And because now Iranians got some rain in different parts of the country, so we will have some increased soil moisture that prevents dust storms. But in general, yes, when dry conditions are there, with any wind blow, you have dust particles all over the place, and they can move kilometers away. So people miles away or even outside Iran can be affected with dust storms.
You mentioned that Tehran is not experiencing this influx of dust from dried out soil. Are other parts of Iran?
So generally speaking, this problem is more severe when you get closer to the Iraqi border, because some dust storms come from the other side. And then close to the Afghanistan border, also in the east, you get a lot of that. We have now more wetlands drying up inside the country, like Lake Urmia in northwest Iran. As we are speaking, like, you know, Iran has gone recently through some rain episodes and snow. So that means that for a few weeks or a few months, we have a Band-Aid in place. But the bad news is that a cold spell has come. So that means that there is more demand for electricity for heating. And when you have to produce electricity with, I would say, dirty sources and fossil sources, then the air pollution would be bad. Plus, you get inversion, actually.
And inversion basically means that the air is kept down at the level of the city instead of wafting up because of weather patterns.
Yeah, so simply put, pollutants cannot escape. That means that the air pollution conditions are worse. Even visibility would be impacted in such cases.
So are there solutions being talked about here or being implemented in Tehran or elsewhere in the country?
theoretical solutions exist, but the question is whether those solutions are practical given the state of Iran's economy and the sanctions, right? So when a country is sanctioned, it deprioritizes the environment. A country that is under sanction would invest in some short-term solutions that are working against the environment, mining more deforestation, more damages to the environment, more water pumping and so on, that worsens the situation, because in that moment, the goal is survival.
Given all the constraints that you have mentioned, primarily sanctions, is there anything that the government could realistically be doing right now to improve air quality for residents?
I mean, normally most of the things are band-aid solutions. So what we would see as before is that some days, because of high levels of air pollution, they have to shut down schools or government offices, encourage people to leave the big cities and just buy time. They also do these things about restriction of use of personal cars. So all these things that are not fundamental solutions, but there are temporary, you know, reactions to the emergency situations, a little bit of a relief, but they won't resolve the issues. And one thing here to understand is sanctions functions as a catalyst. This is not to say that sanctions have caused these problems, but it means that as long as they're there, realistically, we don't see a fundamental shift.
Kaveh Madani is the director of the Institute for Water, Environment, and Health at the United Nations University in Canada.
President Trump has appointed a new envoy to Greenland. The response from Greenland's prime minister: it may sound significant, but it changes nothing for us here at home. On Sunday, Trump named Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry to be the envoy to the semi-autonomous territory, reiterating his claim that control of Greenland is a national security priority for the U.S. Greenland is a territory of Denmark, a NATO ally of the U.S. The prime ministers of Denmark and Greenland jointly released a statement today saying national borders are fundamental principles. You cannot annex another country, not even with an argument about international security. Listen to The World later this week for our hour-long special about Greenland, its relationship to Denmark, and the questions that the U.S. stirred up about who should control the territory. That's this Thursday, Christmas Day, on the show. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Journalist Julia Yaffe grew up as a Russian immigrant in America, deeply aware that the women in her family for generations had been highly accomplished.
I had two great-grandmothers who were doctors, one great-grandmother who was a PhD in chemistry, who had her own lab. One grandmother was a cardiologist, the other was a chemical engineer. And to me, it was completely normal and ordinary.
But when she described these generations of women doctors and scientists to Americans, they thought it was extraordinary. In her latest book, Yaffe explains how the Russian Revolution of 1917 set the stage for women like her relatives to advance in science and medicine, and also how the Soviet system failed them. The book is Motherland, a Feminist History of Russia from Revolution to Autocracy. When we discussed it, Yaffe told me the revolution brought about changes for women that were truly radical in the early 20th century.
In 1918, Soviet women got the right to free higher education. They got the right to civil no-fault divorce. They got the right to paid maternity leave. They got the right to claim child support, even for men who they were not married to, and that child support had to be paid out starting from when the woman was pregnant. They got the right not to have to change their names or follow their husbands when they moved and not ask them for permission to do pretty much anything. They were also required to work outside the home. In 1920, the Soviet Union legalized abortion, becoming the first country in the world to do so. And it was provided by the state for free. And the idea was not just to emancipate women, but to break down the building block of what they saw as capitalist society, which was the family. And they wanted women to work the way and parent the way that men did. So to work outside the home, then to come home and enjoy their children while somebody else did the hard work. Mm. So the idea was to collectivize dishwashing, collectivize cooking, collectivize child rearing and child care, so that women could be free to use their creative and intellectual energies outside the home and for building the workers' utopia. And that, at least, was the idea.
Yeah. Okay. So what was the downside? Because it sounds like socialism was utopian for women.
The downside was that while they were happy to have women working outside the home because they needed all hands on deck to rebuild a country after a world war and a civil war and to industrialize it at a breakneck pace, they didn't feel that funding, you know, state cafeterias or state laundromats or nurseries where working women could drop off their kids or actually helping women with domestic labor, these were not priorities for the men in charge. And so resources were never really invested.
Yeah. So would a cynical version be, let's emancipate the women so they'll work in factories and do other things we need them to do?
Yeah. And, you know, as the Soviet Union accumulates more and more casualties from two world wars, a revolution, a civil war, collectivization, famine, vast political repressions, let's also press them into reproductive service. Let's make sure they have lots of babies. And we're not really going to help them with that because women are strong. They're able to do anything. They'll manage.
New opportunities did open up for women, for example, in the sciences. I mean, your great-grandmother was the first in your family to take advantage of that. Tell us the story of what led her to medicine.
What was interesting about my great-grandmothers is they were all four of them were born around 1900. So they were about 17, 18 years old when the revolution hit. That's the age at which most people start college. The new Bolshevik government threw open the doors of universities that had been closed to them, both as Jews and as women. Three of my great-grandmothers took the new government up on that and went to universities.
Yeah. It's interesting. History and timing also meant that when war broke out, girls and women got military training, which becomes the key to one of the central events of Soviet history, World War II. Describe the roles of women in that war.
So this, to me, was the most incredible discovery for me personally in researching the book. Basically, when the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union in June of 1941, tens and tens and tens of thousands of young women, most of them teenage girls, rushed the recruitment posts and lined up, signed up to serve. These girls were all born after the revolution when the government gave both boys and girls paramilitary training. So girls from the youngest grades in school learned how to shoot a gun next to the boys while they were also learning math and science next to the boys. They had to learn military history. They had to learn how to read a topographical map, how to jump from a parachute stand, how to work with a tractor or a plane or a car engine alongside the boys as they progressed in their education. So when the war started, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of young women who had government certificates for sniper training or for flying a plane. And what ended up happening is over 800,000 young women, again, so many of them were just teenage girls, some as young as 14 found their way into combat. What's crazy is they did it without thinking that they were girls doing boy things. They didn't think that they were enacting something male. They thought of it as inherently female to defend your home and your country, and that these were inherently female talents, you know, to lie in wait and precisely put a bullet in the same exact spot in a German's forehead. And to me, it's extraordinary. One of these women later in life told a historian, "We are a generation not from this universe," which is, I think, just such a powerful sentiment because that kind of experiment has never been repeated.
So the price paid by the Soviet Union for its dead country people in World War II was massive. But the defeat of the Nazis is one of the proudest achievements in Soviet history. What did the glory of the Soviet women during the war, what happened to that after the war?
Well, this is one of the saddest chapters, is that when the men came home, they were lauded as heroes and defenders of the fatherland. When the women came home, everybody suspected them of having sexual relationships with the men in the trenches,
when there were so few men that came home after the war. Of the 27 million dead, about 20, 21 million were men. And other women were jealous. They thought and said, you know, what were you doing in the trenches in such close proximity to the men? And the women were not only not encouraged to speak about their experiences, they were encouraged to be silent. Their memoirs, unlike the memoirs of the men, were not published. They were kind of shamed into silence, even after they had performed these superhuman feats, not only in defending their homeland and their families and defeating Nazism, but in doing something that women had never done before anywhere in the world, which I think is just tragic and incredibly offensive.
I'm speaking with Julia Yaffe, journalist and author of Motherland, A Feminist History of Russia. We've heard about the women in your family who became doctors in the early days of the Soviet Union. Let's turn our attention to the last decades of the 20th century and the waning days of the Soviet Union, when pressure on women grew. I mean, this is going to sound familiar to women today everywhere, the expectation of working outside the home and also doing nearly all the work inside the home. But the Soviet version of that double duty was especially grueling. Julia, explain some of the ways that played out.
Well, the best example I have is my father's mother, who was a chemical engineer who oversaw a lab in a water filtration plant just outside of Moscow. It provided clean drinking water to parts of the city as well as the Kremlin. She had about a dozen people reporting to her, a very senior, important role. But you wouldn't know it from how she lived her life inside the home. She was at work by 8 after dropping her 2 kids off at school. During her lunch hour, she would go out into the forest by the plant and pick mushrooms, which she was then responsible for cleaning and drying and preserving. She hated mushrooms for a long time after that. She then had to, at the end of the day, pick up my father and his sister from school. Then they went to the store, you know, the meat store, where they waited in one line to order the thing. Then they waited in a second line to pay for the thing and a third line to pick up the thing. And then they had to do that again in the milk store and again in the bread store. Then they had to go home where my grandmother cooked dinner from scratch, feed the kids, help them with their homework, clean up with no dishwasher, do the laundry with no washing machine, put them to bed. And then once they were in bed, darn all the socks and sew new clothes, because you couldn't just go to the store and get new things, right? And meanwhile, my grandfather didn't help her with any of that. You know, one historian said women did each of these jobs as if it were her only job. And by the end of the Soviet period, almost all women worked outside the home. They were more than half the labor force, but they did an additional 40 hours of domestic labor after work at home.
Wow.
And that was if they were lucky and lived in the cities, because women who lived in the countryside did an average of 55 hours of domestic labor, while their husbands did about 6 or 7.
So there's a piece of social analysis you present in the book, Julia, about the basic situation of Russian women having to do everything and Russian men falling deeper into unemployment, violence, and alcoholism. The prevalent idea is that the women are fine, but the men need help. Do you see that being true or totally upside down?
I think it's upside down. You know, women were asked to do more and more and more. And the thinking at the time was, you know, women are strong, women are resilient, they'll figure it out, they always do. Whereas the men are fragile, they're brittle, they can't handle drops in socioeconomic status. They fall apart, and so we need to protect and coddle them. And so in 1968, at a time when the West was going through a social and cultural revolution, the Soviet Union was talking about saving the men and asking the women, who made up the majority of the doctors, to do yet another thing, which was to take special extra care of the men because they were seen as so very, very fragile. And if this sounds familiar to you, this idea of the women being so strong and resilient and doing so well professionally and academically that suddenly masculinity is in crisis, that's because it is so familiar.
Yeah. Your family left Russia in 1990 as refugees fleeing anti-Semitism. You were a kid, you grew up in the U.S., and then you became fascinated with Russian history and moved back to stay in Moscow with your grandmother. How did your parents react to that reversal?
Not well. They hated it. They hated it. They had done so much. They had ripped up their roots and moved across the world to a country whose language and culture they didn't know, where they had no connections or a kind of social capital. They did it for my sake and my sister's sake. And 20 years later, I was back living in Russia, having, in their minds, started to undo what they had done for me. So they did not enjoy that.
Julia, let's jump to modern Russia, because there's a new generation of women whom you call giraffes. What's going on with modern young Russian women, and why do you call them giraffes?
Well, I joke that they were giraffes or gazelles because they're just very tall and lanky and beautiful. And when I moved back to Moscow, I was shocked to find these women who were embracing an almost cartoonish version of femininity, and their only goal seemed to be to marry rich and become a stay-at-home trophy wife. And that's a direct response to the exhaustion that so many women felt at the end of the 90s when everything fell, the economy fell apart, the men fell apart, and it was once again on the women to hold everything together. And when Russia starts getting rich in the 2000s, there's this yearning for women to just say, like, okay, can we take a break now? And so for women, that became about investing as much as possible in their bodies and their looks to get a man who was rich. But it spoke to the depth of the failure of the Soviet feminist experiment.
When you were living in Moscow with your grandmother, were you and your grandmother having conversations about this whole phenomenon?
Not really. We were talking about broader political currents happening, and she was busy trying to convince me to just have a kid with anybody. There was this sense bordering on panic that she had, and the most Russian women have, that, you know, if you don't have a kid by the time you're 25, maybe 27, you just never will. And having a child is the most important thing. And it's this model of, you know, the superhuman woman, incredibly beautiful, incredibly stylish, incredibly educated, incredibly accomplished. Oh, and she's an amazing cook. And oh, she keeps an amazing home. And she has these amazing children. Her husband's kind of a lump on a log and useless, but, you know, she's this, you know, supermodel with a PhD who's also a gourmet chef. And that's the model. And it's an exhausting one.
Julia, you didn't have a baby then when you were in Moscow, but you are now a mom.
And no, I'm wondering,
and I'm wondering how that changed how you see yourself in your family's lineage.
Well, I had a child just over a year ago, and I was fully expecting to have a girl so that I could continue this lineage.
Best laid plans.
Best laid plans. Because I expected to have a girl but had a boy while writing this feminist history that is so much about a country where men are so broken and so weak and useless, and yet the women are constantly blamed for it, for this crisis of masculinity, it made me realize how important it is to raise a young man who is not like that. His father is not like that. His two grandfathers are not like that. And, you know, I thought I was going to raise a badass young woman, but instead I'm going to raise a badass young man who respects badass young women.
So, Julia, I won't ask you to predict what Vladimir Putin will do next or how long he rules Russia, but I will ask, how do you imagine the role of Russian women changing in this era of Russian autocracy?
You know, as soon as Putin launched the full-scale invasion in February 2022, people in the West were asking me, once the body bags start coming home, surely the Russian women will come out, right, and protest and make Putin end the war, as if it's on them to end a war that they didn't start and they had no say in starting. I think, you know, Putin is leaning on them even more heavily again, not just to work outside the home, but to do the things that Stalin and Khrushchev were asking Soviet women to do after World War II, when after they had killed so many Soviet men. Putin is doing the same thing. He's asking them to have more and more and more babies. For a country to be a great superpower, it needs an expanding population. It needs to replace all the soldiers it's killing. And again, that's not on the men. That's once again on the women.
You've said before that Russia's future looks like its past and present. Do you imagine that you'll be able to go back to Russia someday?
I hope so. I miss it. I haven't been back in 6 years. I don't know that I'll be able to go back for a very long time. You know, people say that we'll be able to go back when Vladimir Putin dies, but I don't know. I fear that Putinism will outlive Putin in the way that Stalinism outlived Stalin. The system really has to change and become liberalized again. And right now, there's absolutely no political will. I don't see that happening anytime soon. But I do really miss it, and I wish I could go back and see it and chronicle these changes. But I don't want to risk arrest. I'm a mother, and I have responsibilities, not just to myself anymore.
Well, your book is extraordinary, and I feel we've only scratched the surface of the history that you go over in this conversation. Julia, thank you very much.
Marco, thank you so much for having me.
Julia Yoffe's book, published this fall, is called Motherland, The Feminist History of Russia from Revolution to Autocracy. She spoke with us from Washington, D.C.
Rock climbing became an Olympic sport in 2020. That's testament to a surge of interest in competitive climbing all around the world. Earlier this year, the South American continent hosted its first Climbing World Cup, and last month was the first Pan American Cup, a championship for South, Central, and North America. That was in Colombia. Reporter Stan Alcorn was there and got to witness a lot of firsts for competitive climbing in the country. Here's his report from the city of Armenia.
To host its first world-class climbing competition, Colombia had to import some world-class climbing walls from Europe. But at the last minute, organizers learned they didn't have all the parts. And so, early on a Sunday morning, climbers from Chile to Canada are showing up to Plan B, INEM José Celestino Mutis, a public school.
So now we're entering the gym.
On one side of the gym's volleyball court is the bouldering wall, a rickety plywood creation with a lot of lime green paint. Christian Carreras from Chile is in charge of setting the roots of plastic holds the competitors will use to climb to the top. He's sifting through a little sack of plastic chips the size of coins. He picks one up and drills it right at the top of a suitcase-sized plastic triangle. I ask him if he's making it harder or easier to climb. No, it's that it's kind of broken, he says. Because of the way the thin plywood wall bends, there was a gap he needed to fill in. Meanwhile, outside, there's rain dripping on the cushions under the climber's warm-up wall and weighing down the tents.
The tent just collapsed.
The old school wall was a surprise for everyone, but the Latin American climbers seem to take it in stride. When a Colombian climber asks the mom of one of the strongest Argentine climbers for her take, she is unfazed. She says in Argentina, climbing in places like this is very common. Her daughter, Valentina Aguado, used to train on a makeshift wall in their patio. Sometimes she'd wake up at 5 in the morning, realize it was raining, and think, the cushions.
Oh, looks like they're starting.
The climbers competing today are mostly in their teens and early 20s, but they've seen the sport change a lot in their short lifetimes. The Colombian capital of Bogota now has 9 climbing gyms. When Sofia Parrado started 8 years ago,
when you started, there were probably half as many gyms.
Yeah, no, there was like one or two.
Some of those new, more modern gyms were opened by climbers who were here, competing or volunteering or just cheering.
Are you so tuned in, do you not even hear them? Or could you hear people?
No, of course we hear them because they're really loud. And also in Colombia, we are really loud.
On her third try, she nearly made it to the top.
Oh, I just like take a break and say, I can do it. And then like in the fourth time, I was like, yes, 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 please.
Sofia Parrado became the first Colombian to get to the top of a boulder in a Pan American Cup semifinals. Historic, though not quite enough to make it to finals, which were dominated by Canada. And the United States. The winner on the women's side was four-time World Cup champion Natalia Grossman.
It's really cool that we're starting to have events down here. There was like the first World Cup this year in South America ever, and there's going to be one next year. So yeah, hopefully it can continue to grow.
After bouldering comes lead climbing, using harnesses and ropes and scaling a wall that's 50 feet tall. This wall was finished in time, and it's so big and visible, one of the best places to watch is the open-air third-floor food court of the mall across the street. That's where I find Rodrigo Rios eating lunch with his family.
Me parece genial.
He thinks this competition is great. It's the first time they've had such an important sporting event since Lionel Messi was here 20 years ago, playing in the South American Youth Soccer Championship. Of course, if Messi were here today, we'd probably see a bigger crowd. He says when the sport is soccer or volleyball or skating, a lot more people come. Climbing is still a niche sport. In the U.S., the number of participants puts it somewhere between squash and pickleball. But in our social media age, the visual appeal of gymnastic movements high off the ground has been attracting new fans. In fact, the whole time I've been talking to Rios, his daughter Samara has been standing transfixed. I ask her if she's ever seen anything like this before.
No, nunca.
No, never. And does it make her want to try climbing?
No, mucho miedo.
No, too scary.
Mucho miedo.
Better to remain a spectator.
Sí, sí.
I'm waiting in the food court for the finals to start when it starts pouring rain. I see some U.S. parents checking their phones.
Anything about... Yeah. Oh, canceled. Fully canceled.
Yep.
Canceled. Across the street in a soggy tent, they'd already handed out the medals to the leaders from semifinals. Americans and Canadians and Benjamin Vargas of Chile, a country that has some of the strongest climbers in South America and some of the best climbing walls, which Vargas does not think is a coincidence. He says the limits for the sport aren't physical, they're structural. And he predicts we'll see the level of competitors increase across South America as countries get better training centers.
Espero que puedan aprovechar la infraestructura.
He hopes Colombia can take advantage of the walls they built for this competition.
Que siga creciendo la escalada en Colombia.
And that climbing here keeps growing. For the world, I'm Stan Alcorn in Armenia, Colombia.
There are a lot of holidays coming up, including a special celebration for a certain show called The World.
It is our 30th anniversary next week on New Year's Day. We're putting together a special broadcast for the occasion, and we are hoping to hear from you.
In the form of a birthday note telling us what The World means to you. Head to our website, theworld.org, and click on the link in the banner.
Again, that's theworld.org, and get ready for our birthday party next week.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our channel there. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production. production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.